Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love. What are you doing this Lent? The St. Paul Center is streaming their newest video Bible study for free starting Ash Wednesday. Based on Scott Hahn's renowned covenantal theology, this is a study no one should miss. Invite your friends, Catholic or not. Don't miss your chance to see this premium study for free. Go to stpaulcenter.com to sign up today.
Gentlemen, welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Glad you could join us tonight here at the WCAP studios in beautiful Lowell, Massachusetts. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m., bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Good evening, everybody, and good evening, Cindy, who is behind the glass. How are you? Good. Good. She gave me the signal. Tonight, fellow truth seekers, we go beneath the surface on the topic of human nature and sports, part two. And I say part two because our guests are back to talk about this topic. Not coincidentally, right after the New England Patriots win the Super Bowl for the sixth time in the past 17 years. Unprecedented, probably will never happen again in the history of sports, perhaps. But I guess that matters how long the history of sports is. But it's been an incredible feat. So before we get both above and beneath the surface on this topic of sports and human nature, let me introduce our guest tonight. From left to right in your radio, Mr. Dan Flaherty. Dan is the founder of thesportsnotebook.com and the author of the book Great 1980s Sports Moments. Dan was here about a year ago to do a part one on this topic. Dan, welcome back to Beneath the Surface.
Thanks very much. Good to be back, Paul.
Good to have you. And to your right, to your left and to my right is Mr. John Tudoris, our second guest for this evening. John is a regular BTS guest.
Yes, and I'm regular as a regular.
Yes, so you listen to that show again?
Whichever that show is, I may have been listening.
Last year's part one, because that's exactly what you said at the beginning of part
really?
One. Yes.
Wow.
That's exactly the same line.
Yeah, it's funny. I haven't listened to it, but considering it's me talking, I'm not surprised.
978-454-4980 is our phone number. 978-454-4980 is the BTS hotline. Again, tonight's Human Nature and Sports Part 2. Well, gentlemen, we need to begin with what happened last night, and I know this is going to be a podcast, and it's going to be listened to at various times and various dates and various years, so we shouldn't spend a lot of time on it, but in our last night, in our time, the Patriots won the Super Bowl.
Hot diggity. 13-3.
Yep. Did it again.
13-3. Your thoughts?
Dan, after you.
Okay. I guess obviously the Patriots' defense certainly was what stood out the most. It was the complete dominance, and I think for me from a coaching standpoint by Belichick was what stood out. Because I know in the media, Jared Goff, the Rams quarterback, has taken some heat saying his play was some of the worst ever in a Super Bowl. And I'm certainly not going to argue he played well just in watching that game. I didn't really see him miss too many opportunities. I just saw there were no opportunities to be had.
Yeah.
In this day and age of the NFL where, all the rules are tweaked to favor the offense.
And the quarterback, yeah.
Yeah, and the quarterback, to just put on that kind of a defensive dominance, that kind of coverage ability on the receivers.
All right, now here's my question. It just blows me away because it just seems so irrational or illogical what happens last night. And that is, you have two of the offensive powerhouses in the National Football League, both of which have not so great defenses, especially the Patriots, until the past couple of weeks. I watched most of the games through the season. I'm saying this defense stinks. It's horrible. This defense is terrible. They're never going to get far into the playoffs with this kind of defense. Here you have the Super Bowl with two offensive powerhouses. You'd think it would be 41-40, and it's 13-3. It was a defensive Super Bowl. What was that all about?
My two cents is that Belichick knows how to save some things for the playoffs, and sometimes that's defense. He just keeps cards up his sleeve, and what it reminds me of? It's actually baseball. Gary Maddux. So he was a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Atlanta Braves, and I remember one time he threw a meatball like right down the center. I think it was to Jeff Bagwell of the Houston Astros back when they were in the National League, and he cranked it out of the park, and his catcher, after the game, went up to him and says, "What'd you do that for?" I mean, he's calling for something else, just nope, meatball down the middle, and he said, "Why'd you do that?" He says, "Because he's going to be looking for that in the playoffs." Sure enough, when the playoffs came around, he didn't give him any of that, and he had one of his worst hitting performances ever.
Yeah.
In the playoffs. I mean, the Braves just dominated the Astros in the playoffs. And that gets me thinking about Belichick. How Belichick, in the regular season, they're good enough. They're good enough to get into the playoffs.
Yeah.
And he always has something in the tank. And that is one of probably the more amazing things about the Patriots. You wouldn't necessarily think about on surface until you start taking a deeper look. And that is that Belichick understands all facets of the game. And if they have to win via defense, they're going to do that.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts were, again, if we go beneath the surface, as it were, into the personnel on each team. First off, the Patriots defense, I think most of the poor perceptions of them were rooted in early in the season, and I think they did gradually get better as the year went on. They still, as one friend did say to me, like, they have these moments, like, when it falls apart, it all falls apart. But statistically, I believe they were in the top 10 in points allowed per game.
Really?
So that's not a bad defense.
I just remember the last two games against the Bills and the Jets, and then the three playoff games. They had a pretty good defense, especially the Super Bowl, and especially the first half against the Chiefs, and then the entire game against the Chargers. But, gosh, those first, like, 13, 14 game, regular season games, I thought they were a very porous defense. It amazed me.
Well, one thing to remember, too, is it was a high-scoring year overall in the NFL, so relatively speaking, the Patriots still were pretty decent. But, you know, when I was digging into the matchups, and that's something on the Sports Notebook that I was doing on the blog there in the weeks leading up to the game, that the Rams had a real weakness on the inside of their offensive line. Their tackles are really good, but center and the guards were a problem. And you saw the Patriots get very consistent push up that middle there. And then if you look at the defensive backs, you know, Stephon Gilmore has had a great year. I don't think anyone disputes that at all. And then to John's point about Belichick, not only is maybe he's holding something back, but he's had 2 weeks to get ready for this game, too. And certainly does favor, the tactician who wants to, like, pull every last wrinkle, you know, out of there at that point. So. And on the Rams side, too, I mean, the Rams, I think, kind of underachieved defensively during the season. They have really good personnel on the defensive line. We certainly saw that in action last night. They've been kind of spotty in the secondary, but it's a secondary that's more talented than it has played. And sometimes I think it's the underachiever you almost have to watch out for because they're capable of just doing it.
Yes, yes.
Yes, when the money's on the table.
So you both basically think that it was the MVP was Bill Belichick, the head coach.
I would almost say that, if you could give the MVP to the coach, it would certainly be him.
Yeah, and I would say somebody on the defense probably should have gotten instead of Edelman, but Edelman had a decent game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Edelman was a credible choice. I think Hightower might have been a good one.
Hightower, Gilmore, Or even, what's his name? Which one of the twins?
Oh, yeah.
What's his name?
Yeah, McCourty.
Yeah, thank you. Jason McCourty.
The one who broke up
the touchdown. Yeah, I mean,
that's right.
That turned around the whole game. I mean, if that was a touchdown,
right.
You never know who would have won this game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what a play out of nowhere. Incredible. 978-454-4980. We're talking about human nature in sports tonight on Beneath the Surface. What do you guys think about that play that got the Los Angeles Rams into the Super Bowl, that non-call from the referee against the Saints? And what would you do about that if you were the commissioner?
I'll leave that to Dan, only because I didn't watch the game.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it was on all of the highlight reels, but go ahead.
The call was atrocious. There isn't any getting around it. I know, and then in the aftermath, there was some discussion that the commissioner had the power to, like, replay the game or replay it from the point of the foul, which kind of brought to mind, for those of us of a certain age, the Pine Tar game between the Royals and the Yankees in 1983.
Wow. Did they play that again?
They started from the point where George Brett's home run was overruled. So, like, on an off day, they played like an inning and a third of baseball.
Interesting.
Kansas City, New York.
I didn't know that. I remember the scene where Brett came out and he was very angry.
Yeah.
And he was about to kill the umpire.
I like to forget. Yeah. That's raw rage.
Yeah. But they did play that again. Couple of innings? Okay.
Yeah. So they reversed the ruling and then picked up.
Could that ever happen in an NFL playoff game?
I don't see how. Talk, like, and they would have to decide, like, almost immediately on the spot.
Yeah,
and they're not going to just do it in some random afternoon. Like, it's going to be on television. They're going to pick it up on Monday night or something like that.
Well, suppose they make a new rule that New York, the offices in New York, can overrule a referee's call on a penalty during any game, playoff game or regular season game. Would that be too much? I mean, when does this become too much of outside influences getting involved, whether it be the television replay or people in New York or what have you?
Is to let it play.
So you would rather see less interference and less stoppage of play?
From upstairs? Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Less is definitely more.
But you're okay with replay system as it is with the three...
I think it's good that they have instant replay to help out as far as the human element goes. And I kind of like it in football how they allow you to challenge.
Yeah.
And if you get it right, you're fine. But if you don't, you actually lose your timeout.
However, they don't allow you to challenge referees' calls or non-calls like that. Do you think they should be able to do that now? That's my question.
That is a fair one. I'll let Dan.
Yeah, I've long advocated. I think any call should be reviewable. And I know the argument people make is, well, it's a judgment call. And I guess my response has always been like, duh. You know, I mean, that's the job of an official to make a judgment. And everybody's judgment is better if you slow it down for them.
Yeah.
That how do we know that official who didn't throw the call didn't regret it within 5 seconds of not throwing it, but then he's in a position of, okay, I can't pull it out now.
Right.
It's going to look like the crowd talked me into it.
Right. Right.
So, like,
good point.
But to John's point about less is more, I do agree on that point as well. So while I would broaden...
You can't have it both ways, though, can you?
Well, you can if you can limit the number of challenges.
Oh, how many would you have?
I would just say it's, you know, 3 challenges per game.
Okay.
And that's it. I mean, when they're done, they're
done.
And
you can challenge anything.
And you can challenge anything. If you want to blow it trying to get an opposing offensive lineman for holding in the second quarter, go for it. But you're not going to have it in your back pocket at the end.
And then you have a problem of, well, the cameras didn't get this guy holding him. And whereas in other calls, the camera got this guy holding him.
Right.
So now the camera people are involved. You have to get, like, a camera on every single person that's on the field at all times, if you're going to really do this seriously.
Right. Well, this would probably be where I would say, like, I'm not ready to do it that seriously.
Right.
And I think if we actually, I'll make a broader societal point regarding the way we watch football here. We have to get over this notion, and you hear this phrase often in the media, what's most important is to get every call right. It's like, no, it really isn't.
It isn't?
No, the most important thing is to produce an enjoyable football game for people to watch and to have a sense that there was a credible ending with the winner and the loser. And the problem with the New Orleans game is there was a feeling that the winner was not really credible. But, I mean, I think all of us who watch sports know that there are enough close calls over the course of a game that you're willing to just let most of them kind of balance out throughout. And that's why I think you can just say, like, look, the coaches get their three challenges. No more automatic reviews of turnovers and scoring plays. It's just the only ones we review.
Not even the last 2 minutes. No automatic reviews of touchdowns,
well,
for example.
I should say, two minutes, okay. I would stick with the current rule, which is the booth can initiate it, because you don't want a coach to try to use it as a timeout or something like that if he doesn't have any. But yeah, just a very limited number of reviews that are in the hands of the coach for all but the last 2 minutes, and that's it. And you know what? If there's a bad call that you don't have a challenge for, I mean, tough. You need to manage that better, and you need to accept the fact that we are going to miss some calls. You know, the important thing is you're trying to get the really big ones that people are going to remember right.
Do you agree with that, John?
I would say I'm largely on board with his sentiments, certainly the underlying principles. And I would also add, too, that when it comes to ensuring that the calls that they do call are generally and mostly right, is that in all the major sports, they have their own internal review process for all their umpiring and referees. So if they are missing calls, they actually bring that up, and that can make or break someone who's an official.
Right.
I mean, if you're consistently missing calls, you can pretty much kiss your tenure as a big league umpire goodbye.
All right. Here you go. Our first segment on Beneath the Surface, where we stayed above the surface talking about the Super Bowl and the teams that got there and didn't get there after the break. We will delve a little beneath the surface on the nature of sports and human nature and how they go together. 978-454-4980. Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. Be back in a moment. Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. Cindy playing Backfield in Motion to bring us into segment number two on our subtopic tonight is, or our topic tonight, that is our subtitle, is Human Nature in Sports, Part 2. And with our guest, Mr. Daniel Flaherty, founder of SportsNotebook.com and author of the book Great 1980 Sports Moments, and Mr. John Tudoris, regular Beneath the Surface host. All right, ready to go Beneath the Surface?
Yeah,
let's do it. All right. Yeah. Why other sports?
Fun, activity, tribalism, all rolled in one.
Why do we need fun?
Oh, leisure is super important to our nature.
Yeah?
If we don't have leisure, if we don't have play, we cannot be fulfilled as people.
I'm a couch potato when I watch these games. I'm not playing.
Oh, but internally in your mind you are.
So I need internal play in order to be happy.
To a certain degree, because play can happen in the mind or can actually be like you're physically doing things. It's basically when you're doing things without an actual purpose or end. Now, in the case of actual games, there does be sort of a purpose, if you will, but it's not like you're doing something in life per se. I mean, like, you know, for example, I'm building this or that. It's a game, so it's sort of a proxy for life in some way.
Games, sports are proxies for life. Why not just live life?
Why
go with the proxies?
I like to think that variety is the spice of life. You know, why do we have music, right?
Well, music is entertainment.
Uh-huh. It so is
moves,
sports.
It moves the heart and the mind. So sports does too, you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, sure.
By the way, I'm not challenging you in why do you people like sports, because I'm the biggest sports fan in the world.
You are so Socraticizing.
I'm actually playing Socrates here, but I'm also, a part of me wonders why I get so involved, why I'm so passionate, why my heart is in this thing where I'm rooting for.
Why you say, John, why are you calling me while the game is on?
Yeah, why do you call me when the Patriots game is on, John? Dan, why do I care about people I've never met that were probably, most of them probably were not brought up in the New England area, that are making lots of money doing this, and I make one-tenth of what they make, probably, if that. Why do I care so much?
You know, I was contemplating that today. And we can even, I'll even add to the mystery a little bit because, you know, my girlfriend before the game, who's not at all a sports fan, noted that the Rams kicker, there was an article floating around about him that he's a very devout Christian and talked about how the importance of life was to get your family to heaven.
I heard about that.
And she was kind of like, I might have to root for him. And I gave her a glare. Like,
yeah. Well, my wife said something similar. Yeah.
And she didn't follow through with it. Right, but it's one of those things that does get me thinking, like, well, you know, really, in a rational world, why wouldn't she? You know, like,
I might like, you know, the people on the other team a lot better if I met them.
Right. We have no idea how we would.
But that's irrelevant.
And one of the things I think that one of the reasons why we all care so much is there is a shared experience in following our sports teams, that we're all kind of in it together. And the best example I can think of would be like last October. Now, of course, I'm a Red Sox fan, but I'm from Milwaukee. And as baseball fans know, the Brewers got to within one game of the World Series.
Yeah.
And I'm not even a Brewers sympathizer or anything, but when they lost that game, I just was like sick to my stomach. And I was sick for all of my friends and family members that I know were Brewers fans. And I was thinking I wanted them to be able to go to a World Series game. You know, and I think on some level, that connection we feel like with our surrounding area is a reason we like why we care so much. I think we should add that's a healthy reason why we care so much. There's probably a whole lot of other reasons that maybe aren't quite as healthy. But like, I think that's a good and valid reason as to why we care.
Let's ponder that a little bit. I don't know people who live in my area. I don't know people who live in Boston. I don't know people who live in, look, I know a handful of people, right? 99.99% of them in this area I've never met in my life. Why do I care about sharing an experience with them about a team filled with people I've never met who were brought up in all over the country?
I think part of it has to do with our communal nature. No person is an island.
Okay.
I mean, when we don't ponder just that with have me. Individual joys all by our lonesome, we actually have communal joys, too. Communal happiness.
And a team winning the Super Bowl gives us joy because?
Because our team won. Why else?
Of course. Well, that's
won.
That's the surface answer, and I hear you.
Yeah.
And I'm jubilant. And you know, I'm still basking in the afterglow. But I just want to know why.
Well, Land over to you.
Well, I'm glad our philosopher genius is troubled because I have pondered this question for about 20 years of like, why do I get this worked up about these guys and everything? And
and you're right. Worked up is the real.
Oh yeah, no, worked. I mean, being a sports fan, I'm going to be honest. In a lot of ways, it's a miserable thing.
Oh, it is. It's horrible.
You're worried far more often than you're happy.
Yeah, you know, you're right.
Yeah, within 2 weeks, we're going to be focused on the next season and if Brady can do it again. You know, it's like,
funny. I still hurt from the Patriots losing the Super Bowl to the New York Giants 5 years ago. And the other one before that in 2008, which was, 10, 11 years ago?
When they were undefeated.
Still hurting to this day.
Mm-hmm.
All of those Red Sox losses, those heartbreaks, I'm still hurting from.
Mm-hmm.
The wins I feel good about, but it seems like the hurts hurt more than the wins give jubilation, no?
Oh, it's definitely true. There's no question about that. And again, because as soon as you win, like the afterglow kind of disappears fairly quickly. And like I'm already kind of starting to get a little agitated about the Celtics. You know, we talked a little bit at the break about that, and I'm kind of like, okay, they've been underachieving all year, and like now, and they're on the clock now. They've got to be the third team in line to do it here.
So it's almost like you're staving off heartbreak. You're not necessarily gaining a lot when you win.
That's exactly right. And I think, and even more so for people in Boston now, because like the proportion of joy that you can get after, you know, each one of these 12 championships that the city's had does decrease.
And 12 championships in 17 years with the four major sports. Hockey, baseball, football, and basketball. Incredible. What a run.
It's unprecedented. And I mean, Boston had already was the leader. I had done some research on this of the four sports cities.
Yeah.
Cities that got all four of their teams to win, like how long of a stretch did it take them? And like Boston was already ahead like a few years ago. And like I think they've got to just be ahead by a lot.
yeah.
right now. I think those, like, Los Angeles in the early 80s might have done it.
And New England's sports fans are the most passionate in the whole country. Are they not?
I would say just about. I mean, some might say Philadelphia fans, but actually Dan and I were reminiscing about a Red Sox-Philadelphia Phillies interleague game from, what was that, like 10 years ago or so?
Yeah, 06 and, it was.
And
yeah.
there were a ton of Boston fans over at that Phillies game in Philadelphia, so much so that after the game, which the Red Sox won, my cousin had the sports radio on for Philly area, and the sports radio host was saying, "Hey, what's up, Philadelphia fans? Why are there so many more Boston fans making noise than you guys? What's going on?" So that definitely does say something about Boston fans, for sure.
Yeah. Now, it's not necessarily the case when it comes to college sports or high school sports, but professional sports it is.
Yeah, yeah, because there are definitely areas of the country where college sports rule, for sure. Particularly with, like, in the South with some of the football colleges. Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah, and I'm from the Midwest, and college sports, again, they're very big as well. And, again, it's the whole communal nature of things. Like, everybody just rallies. Like, for me to root for Wisconsin in a lot of ways doesn't make sense. I mean, I didn't go to school there or anything like that. I mean, it's a flaming left-wing campus. It's like it runs contrary to every value I have. But, I mean, like, but I'm crushed if they lose a
Hey, I feel the
game.
Same way about, you know, Boston and Massachusetts in general, about their politics and their ideology. I don't, you know, I don't want any part of it. And yet, I feel such a camaraderie with these flaming liberals when it comes to the sports teams.
I know. You know, and
it's pretty funny.
Yeah, and I think something like, and I'm just throwing this out here as a point of pondering, is there a part of it that just says, like, this is, in a very small way, it's a way you love thy neighbor, like, you know, like, hey, look, I
perhaps
disagree with you on every level, but, like, we share this.
Yes.
And we can come together on this.
Two stories come to mind on that. One is the Olympics. If you remember the, this is in the 80s, I don't know if it was the 84 or the 88, where the U.S. and Russia, their volleyball teams, were pretty much the best in the world. And I just remember...
Men's volleyball?
Yes, men's volleyball. Yeah. And I think, like, Karsh Karai was just barely a newborn babe at that point. And just, they were talking about how well they got along, the players. So regardless of how the governments were at each other's throat, the players, on a human level, they met at the sports, and they were competitors for sure. I mean, very competitive. They definitely wanted to dominate the other team, but as people, that actually allowed them to get closer. When you think about it, like football, of all the four major sports in the U.S., by far, football is the most brutal of them. Mm. And yet, after every single game, what do they do more so than any of the other sports?
Tell me.
They're hugging each other. They're like, hey, what's going on? To the guys on the other team.
Yeah.
The guys that they're pounding the snot out of, you know, in chest that hurts.
We had talked about this the first time we got together with this topic, about how after the sporting event, very often the opponents get together and either, you know, shake hands or give themselves a hug or a pat and say, you know, great game. You know, we talked about kickboxing and mixed martial arts, and they do it after they kill each other. They're hugging each other. Football, basketball, more and more is doing that now. After each game, they come over and there's a lot to say about that. Why all of a sudden? Not all of a sudden. I suppose in the past few years, because I remember back in the Larry Bird days, they hated the Detroit Pistons and they hated the Los Angeles Lakers, and it was personal. All of a sudden, it's not personal anymore.
That's definitely true. That a lot of old timers like kind of dislike it. That I know, you know, like LeBron is good pals with pretty much half the league.
Yeah.
And, you know, like even he and Kyrie Irving have made their peace now after the split in Cleveland.
Right.
But I know when LeBron was in Miami, it was rumored that Pat Riley didn't like it so much when LeBron would get filmed, you know, on a banana boat with Carmelo Anthony or something like that.
Right. They're supposed to be opponents.
That's right. Yeah.
Anyways.
Now, this is an area where, like, I'm generally a traditionalist, but I kind of like the modern way of doing things. I don't think it's actually necessary to hate the person you're playing basketball against in order to do it effectively.
You know, I think... and you probably remember better than I, Dan, now some of the, when you think about players hating the other players, so to speak, a lot of that's the, like, the 1980s basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about Magic was saying, when I'm on the court, I hate the other guy over there. Now, when I'm off the court, like, Isaiah Thomas is his best buddy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on the court, Isaiah Thomas, you're my worst enemy, you know? Or I mean, what's that famous basketball game with the Celtics and the Sixers, and you had Dr. J, and he's slugging Larry Bird, and Larry Bird's being held back by Charles Barkley when he's a rookie.
Oh, yeah.
They even have a nice snapshot of that over at the rest stop on the Mass Pike. Is kind of interesting. But, I mean, just this idea that they, on the court, they hate each other, but as people, even then, I think to a certain degree, they really did respect each other, at least some of them. Larry Bird didn't respect Bill Laimbeer. That's another story.
No, yeah. Well, Laimbeer was a dirty player, too.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah, that's what I was thinking of, Bill Laimbeer, big time. Do you think that sports is a substitute for something that no longer goes on in modern society?
Debate. Good argumentation.
Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. I think of G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah?
So if anyone's not familiar with him, just kind of a famous British author from about 100 or so years ago. If you recall the Father Brown Mysteries, which came out around the same time as the Sherlock Holmes. That's him. He wrote all those. He was also a bit of a philosopher and a journalist and novelist and all the above, social commentary. And anyway, he would have a series of famous debates between him and George Bernard Shaw. And so here's G.K. Chesterton, very astute, very learned, very witty theist, meaning he believes in God, absolutely. And George Bernard Shaw did not. But both of them were very famous intellects. And when they were having these debates, they would really go at each other. I mean, sometimes, you know, they're making little, funny digs at each other. But for the most part, it was about the argument, the ideas. And then no matter what went on in the debate, what was really fascinating is they would be found drinking a beer together after the debate. So, and that when we're hearing about these sporting events where these players are really going at each other, and then afterwards, they're friends. They're getting along. It's almost like the combat, being able to engage with the other person, in a certain sense, really respecting them as people, enables you to actually come to a better understanding and know them more. A
couple of things about that. Number one, the difference between argumentation and debate versus sport is that the former, the goal or the aim is supposed to be objective truth.
Yes.
So it's not to win the argument, it's for both parties to come to a better understanding of the truth, yes?
Ideally, yes.
The goal of a sporting event is to win the thing. There is no objective truth when it comes to a sporting event, it's just, you know the rules, it's you against them and you want to win. You don't want to assist each other into a tie.
Yeah, well,
so that would be a difference.
But if I'm in a debate, the competitive part of me says, I still do want to win, and I want the better argument. I want to have the better argument if I'm going to debate.
All right, we hear the music. We need to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk more with our guest Dan Flaherty from thesportsnotebook.com. Author of Great 1980 Sports Moments, Mr. John Truders, and myself, Paul Morano, here on Beneath the Surface. Be right back. Back to segment number three, Beneath the Surface, WCAT. Paul Morano here with my guest, Dan Flaherty, founder of thesportsnotebook.com. Thesportsnotebook.com. There you go. And author of Great 1980 Sports Moments, Mr. John Truders, and myself. Gentlemen, before the break, we had mentioned a little bit about the notion of sports as a kind of tribalism. In that respect, is it similar to politics?
Yes.
Yes, you would say, Dan.
Yeah, because in fact, like when I got into politics, like late high school and college, the first thing I got into was the competitive aspect of it and matching up candidates and campaigns and, you know, and suddenly, and for a while there, I was on a stretch of, like, you know, knowing all the details of who won and by how many percentage points with the same knowledge that I would have of who won past World Series. And I think where the negative side is, like, I would feel the need to carry that into political discussion. Yeah. And, which is basically what we see happening around us everywhere, where it becomes my side has to win.
It's yes. About. And that's particularly the case today with the two political parties, yes?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And my conclusion was maybe I should just, like, save the competitive stuff for watching sports and focus. Politics should be about getting to the truth of something.
Yeah. John, I definitely see a similarity here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I thought Dan hit it on a really good point about politics at its core. It really is about the truth of people as a community. Really.
Look, that's the ideals. But yeah. like you said, it doesn't always happen that way.
Mostly it doesn't happen that way. I mean, the Plato's ideal of a philosopher king or a philosopher ruler is unfortunately just that oftentimes. I mean, history has shown a few examples that have gotten there pretty good. But that super duper ideal is
well, the problem I see with investing your heart into either a sports team or a political party is that the tendency, if you're not a philosopher type like you and me, the tendency is to always try to defend your side. And you're never able anymore to have an objective look at things.
Oh, sure.
For example, if there's a controversial call on the field, you know, the umpire is crazy for calling them out when your team was really safe, you know, or when there's a, you know, you have a president of your political party in office, you're always smoothing over the edges and emphasizing the good things rather than just being objective. Now, personally, I've never registered for a party affiliation. I've always been independent. And that helps me, I think, look at all of the things that particular politicians do, and I can judge it objectively. I don't have that tribalism instinct in me when it comes to that. When it comes to sports, not so much. Maybe is it better, Dan, to just take an objective view and not get invested in a sports team?
I will just say this: I've tried it, and it was not very fulfilling. Or anything, where you just try to say, like, okay, I'm just going to watch this clinically as an analyst. And there are a lot of games that I do watch, but, like, there's also a part. But, like, for me to really lock in, like, I have to care.
Yes.
And, you know, now, fortunately, like, I follow it closely enough that in most cases, I at least have enough of a preference.
So if your heart isn't into one of the two teams, then you don't care so much. I know that's the truth of me, too. You just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the same thing can be said about politics.
Well, I think that's absolutely necessary. If you want to, like, do politics in a healthy way, you have to divest yourself of emotions. I mean, there are various, for me, it's not so much parties, but, you know, different political movements and factions that I've very strongly identified with over the years. Probably so. But I would find there was a tendency to, I would usually join on to them for two or three reasons that, like, I was attracted to. And then the snowball would start.
But would you defend them if they're wrong?
There got to a point where I would at a certain point. Now, this was more, again, when I was in college and shortly thereafter when I was also drinking way too
problem.
Much, too. So, you know, there's a little rashness of mind going on as well. So, but I think your goal in trying to mature a little bit, and hopefully I'm on that path, is that you can pull back and look at it objectively.
But not if you're a true partisan.
No.
And yeah,
true partisans run the
problem.
Country today.
Yeah, that's the problem. I think, John. What do you think?
I think with politics, and I'll agree with Dan on this, is that if you're going to do it right, there has to be a certain dispassionate disconnect from the parties.
Right, but not from the issues.
Not from the issues, that's correct. Because the issues are centered more around truth, whereas the parties are more about staying in power.
Now, of course, with the issues that I'm passionate about, it usually does align to one of the two political parties.
Right.
No question about it. I'm not officially affiliated with them, but it does align with them. So usually I'm rooting for them. But since I'm not in that family per se, I can always have that objective look at if, for example, Trump is doing something bad, I can say it with no problem.
Paul, I heard what you said.
If it's my opinion that he's doing something wrong.
You. You're fired.
Yes, thank you, Mr. thank you, Mr. Trump. But that's the point I'm trying to make. With sports, it's even more irrational than that.
You know, for me, like sports, I a lot of times I think I can get to the point of reasonable rationalness. That
yeah, but can you convince your heart? For example, if the Patriots are going to lose last night,
mm-hmm.
your intellect would say, it's only a game. It's good that that the other team is going to win. Maybe their fans will be happy about this. Your head might be saying this, but can it convince your heart?
No, not on that front. I think when I was saying, like, to be dispassionate, you know, you brought up the example of, like, an official's call, which is the most notorious example of fans rushing to their side, that I'm generally able to just say, like, look, I want to get them to get the call right, even if it does hurt
your team,
my team, just because it doesn't feel very good to when you win.
You want to win fair and square.
That's right, yeah. Now, admittedly, when the teams that you followed have won championships upon championships, your level of sportsmanship rises.
Right.
So no judgment on anybody who roots for a long-suffering team. But
right. But I think we're getting to something here that needs to be dug and delved onto, and that is, why do we hold on to a tribalism when we're no longer a tribal society?
That's because we've been tribes for so long. I mean, think about it. I mean, the large governmental structures that we think about often haven't been around very long in world history.
So it hasn't evolved out of us, out of our nature?
No.
We're tribal by nature still?
No, we're tribal by nature. We're familial by nature. And, and we really can't get it out of us. And so particularly if we're not getting it on the local level, We almost, our nature wants some sort of proxy.
And I would also say this. When the world was tribal, and a lot of it still is, but, you know, when the whole world was a tribal world, and it was, say, pre-civilization, or at least pre-Western civilization, your tribe was your life. I mean, if another tribe was attacking, you better win that fight, or else either you would die or you'd be taken as a slave. I mean, your life was on the line with these tribal fights. I think perhaps we take that whole thing, which is deep, you know, obfuscated in our hearts, and direct it towards our sports teams. And that's why we're so passionate about it, even though it doesn't make all that much sense now to be that passionate about a game, to win a game or not.
Yeah, I think if we actually lived in real tribes, we probably wouldn't care as much about sports teams because we would actually be getting it more on a natural level.
Yes, that's my point.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, I'm not now, I don't know how much history background you have, but I'm just thinking here, like, the competitions in the Roman Colosseum, and if we go back to medieval period and the knights jousting. Now, I don't know really what as far as I know, they didn't have teams or anything like that,
in
personal combat. But, like, I do think, like, the tribes that are not developed, the competition still seems to me to be equally fierce. I mean, now it could be that there's not as much time to devote to doing it in a healthy way.
Not as much
way.
Leisure.
So you're fighting literally for your life. But if, like, you were going to play basketball together,
and could you say back in those days, these sporting events, if you could call them that, were practices for war? The jousting and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're absolutely associated with that. I mean, you have your knights there. I mean, all those things. I mean, even now, I mean, our combat sports, even think not just like mixed martial arts, but what about like fencing and swordplay and all these other things? They all have their roots in actual combat.
So this is then today, in modern life, it's substitutions for war. Back then, it was practicing for war.
Oh, sure.
Could we make that statement?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
All of us, to one degree or another, man, woman, and child, has some degree of us that... I don't know if I would say we're built for combat, but in some way we have that. Our fallen nature almost requires it. That old school survival instinct of fighting for something.
Well, let's go all the way back. As a species, we've always fought against the elements, right?
Yes.
And we've always fought against the animals, particularly the ones that we wanted to eat, and the ones that were attacking us, so that we wanted to survive. So we've always been fighting against something. And then with the tribal system, we've always been, since you mentioned sin, original sin, if you want to get theological, we've always been fighting against each other, too. So perhaps now that we live in a modern world and we have modern ways of getting food and remaining sheltered, all that's taken care of.
Yeah.
And we're in a large country now where, you know, Rhode Island doesn't fight Massachusetts with spears and swords.
But they do in basketball.
That's college hoops. So perhaps we are, you know, we are substituting all of that that remains in the human heart, and again, directing them towards our sports teams and a healthy alternative.
And I would just add too that I think as culture has developed over the centuries, not just sports but also other forms of entertainment.
Okay.
Think about it. Shakespeare came on the world stage about 400 years ago or so, 500 years ago, and but would he have been able to be Shakespeare in feudal times? I mean when it was more of a tribe against tribe. Really, there needs to be some degree of stability in order for these cultural aspects to flourish.
So when your survival is not at stake on a daily or regular basis, there is more time to develop sports so that we can redirect our animosity or our aggressiveness.
And not just sports, theater, all the arts, all of those, I think, would be grouped in the same category.
Dan?
I think that's true, but I guess we'll throw out an example. Like, let's say a working-class town in Pennsylvania that's just been battered by the loss of the steel mills. Turn the clock back a little bit. You know, poor communities in Oklahoma, Alabama. The story is, and it's generally accurate, that they really care about their sports teams.
Yes.
Now let's take some cosmopolitan liberal sitting out there in Los Angeles. In Hollywood. They probably could have cared less about the Super Bowl last night.
I think you're right. I think you have a very good point there. What does that tell us?
Well, I think we're back to tribalism.
Yeah.
You know, we've kind of followed this in a circle.
Those areas that feel more threatened, the need for survival is more conscious, maybe they are more apt to hold on to their sports team as a kind of a
metaphor,
diversion.
Maybe.
Metaphor,
perhaps?
Perhaps living metaphorically through them.
And I would actually say the players, too. A lot of your best players didn't really grow up in comfort. That's not to say that they didn't have, you know, some material needs met, but I mean, there's countless stories of people just coming out of poverty, and what's their way out of poverty? Sports.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. 978-454-4980 if you want to give us a call here on Beneath the Surface. We've got about 3 minutes left. When did organized sports begin? Does any guys know the history?
At least if we're talking of four major sports, we're looking at the late 1800s.
Baseball the late 1800s, and then basketball in the early 1920s or 1900s.
Naismith, the 1910s?
I want to say Naismith was early 20th century.
Football, maybe mid-20th century?
40s? It was earlier than that. They were playing by the turn of the century.
Football? American football?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It was collegiate first. Yeah. And then
I want to say 1884.
All right. So anyway, American sports, organized American sports, right around the late 1800s, early 1900s, they took root, right?
Yeah.
Would you say?
Mm-hmm.
When did soccer take root, and why the heck is it so popular throughout the entire world?
Except the United States.
Yeah, except here. Any thoughts on that really quick?
It's safe. It's easy to play.
It's cheap, too. I'm
going to go with the cheap, it's easy to play is probably.
Yeah.
And we probably don't need to make it a lot more complicated than that. I think the bigger mystery is why it's never really caught on in the United States, given
that. Yeah, that is an interesting mystery.
So,
But do you think that since we had just mentioned that American sports took root organizationally right around the late 1800s, early 1900s, that it has something to do with the Industrial Revolution?
It's funny, as you were setting that up, I was thinking that they all happened shortly after the Industrial Revolution started to boom.
Yeah. Now, is there a relationship there?
Definitely in regards to basketball and hockey, those two were go hand in hand, because once you had these cities develop, which only were able to develop because of the Industrial Revolution, they put in these civic center arenas.
Yeah.
And they needed a regular way to fill the seats.
Yeah.
And what better way to do that is to have indoor sports. And they wanted to have sports where they could actually overlap the seasons, so they can get as many butts in the seat on a regular basis as possible.
So they found out it was a moneymaker.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Basketball and hockey go hand in hand professionally.
Dan, last word?
I just had a thought in my mind. Now it's escaped. Yeah, and related to that, at the point in the 20th century when it became popular, we were getting a large amount of immigration from places like Ireland at the time as well, where sports are very popular, and they were all Catholic and didn't have a very severe conservative Protestant dogma.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Dan Flaherty from thesportsnotebook.com. Mr. John Tudors, thank you so much for talking about human nature in sports once again. Maybe we'll have a part three. Who knows?
BreadBox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.